rise for their majesties of Royally Obsessed, the podcast for all things royals.
Three cheers for His Majesty the King.
Welcome back to Royally Obsessed. I'm Roberta.
And I'm Rachel.
And before we dive into the royal news of the week, as always, follow us on Instagram at Royally Obsessed Podcast. Also send us a note, info@gallerypodcasts.com. That's Gallery Podcasts with an S on the end. We've gotten so many great listener notes recently, so keep those coming, please, please, please. Rachel, it's so lovely to see your face. I don't think we can say what a week every single time.
I feel like it's becoming
so repetitive.
I also feel like it's becoming a situation where I can't also say that I haven't seen you in a while, because I think that we are basically back to the point of like falling asleep with our phones to our ears, because there's so much royal stuff going on. But we do have a lot to talk about this week. We are joined by the incomparable Charles, the 9th Earl Spencer, and Princess Diana's brother, of course, to talk about his new memoir, A Very Private School. It has been, what a week, a privilege and honor to have him on the podcast. We're also talking about another launch, American Riviera Orchard. Can we call it the Take 2.0, Roberta? I think so.
I think we can. Yes, definitely.
There's a lot more. Kate has been spotted officially, and there's video to prove it. There's early conversations happening about Trooping the Color, a royal birthday coming up this week, and a lot more to dig into. So much royal news.
And now it's time for the weekly royal cocktail.
I know, Rachel, so much broke after we finished recording, after our last episode aired. So we have a lot of catching up to do. And to get through all that, of course, we leave time for our royal refreshment. This week, in honor of Princess Eugenie's birthday, we are sipping vodka sodas. I put a Cheers. Lovely big ice cube into my glass here.
Oh my gosh, do you have like a special ice cube mold that you do?
Yes. So we have a giant cube, and then we have round ones that are really nice as well.
And it makes a difference, right?
It feels more cocktail bar-esque,
or is there more to it than that?
It does. Although I have to say, I mixed up gin and tonic instead of vodka soda because we didn't have vodka. So I have to go to the liquor store at some point this weekend.
But yes.
Cheers to Princess Eugenie. Happy birthday.
Yes.
This was from her Harper's Bazaar profile way back when, where she talked about her favorite cocktail was vodka soda. So I'm in agreement, actually.
When I revisited that profile, it is such a glamorous profile. And it's
stunning.
Royal Lodge. And I just feel like to get that access, I want more of that.
And those dresses, embroidered, embellished. Oh my gosh, she's just so, so gorgeous. All the photos in that shoot were just so stunning.
I know. Can I tell you about a royal sighting that I had this weekend? I've just been dying to talk to you about it.
You saw Kate.
You heard it here first. Not quite.
We crack ourselves up over here.
Yes. Oh, we really do. I was out for a lovely stroll because the weather in New York City, and I think in Philly too, was just fantastic. It was like almost 65 degrees. It was so
nice.
Warm. Headed to my favorite place, Brooklyn Bridge Park, strolling on the promenade. And who do I look up to see? Reading, I did not disturb, but Prince Philip, aka Tobias Menzies, from the crowd.
Back from the dead. Whoa. Oh my goodness. Wait, Tobias Menzies. I'm a huge fan from Outlander, too.
Yes, yes. And he is in a play right now at St. Anne's Warehouse in Brooklyn called The Hunt. So he's in the area, but I felt like that was just such a royally adjacent sighting that only this community would care about. And I was really excited and just couldn't like linger on it too long because that's the New York way. But I, you know, had this moment for myself and then.
But you immediately recognized him. Like you were like, that's Prince Philip,
season 3 and 4. And he had like a hat. Like he was just reading and relaxing and felt like it was just, you know, he was enjoying the Sunday afternoon. So
did he see you spotting him?
No. And I was super chill. I just kept moving.
You have to be chill in Brooklyn. There's so many people out
and
about.
Yes, exactly. But did you have a nice weekend? You wore your Diana jacket.
I did. It was the perfect St. Patrick's Day attire. And so she got her first public debut. More to come from that.
Was it comfortable? Were you happy about it?
It was perfect because it was actually a little bit cold that day. So it was perfect. I wore just leggings and sneakers with it. But it was a very casual weekend. So.
Well, there's nothing better than a royal investment that you then are like, yes, I made the right choice, you know?
Yes, yes. That the spend per wear goes down where you're just like
you feel good
feeling
about
good
it.
About it. Yep.
All right. Well, let's move on to our listener email. We have a couple of quick notes. We've been getting so many wonderful notes from everyone. So thank you so much for writing in. We're going to try to squeeze in two just to keep a good cadence here, but we heard from Lauren in North Carolina. She writes that her uncle recently married the most lovely woman from South Africa, who I've loved getting to know. She formerly worked in London as a nurse, and so we always love to compare notes on the royal family. Her brother also works at a very fancy school in England, which happens to be Marlborough College. So this is my words. Per Lauren, she says that Kate recently toured the facility as a potential school for George. She also shared a tidbit from her aunt's brother about Eugenie. This brother also coached Princess Eugenie on the squash team when she was a student at Marlborough and reported that Eugenie was, quote, very down to earth and a delight to have on his team. These are such fun royal tidbits and also compelled me to go and look back because I remember when we saw or heard rumblings about Kate being at Marlborough, and that was around October 2023. Richard Eden from the Daily Mail had the scoop. I wonder if this sighting by the brother was timed to that.
Interesting. And also apropos, given it's Eugenie's birthday this week. Yeah. I love that.
Yeah.
All right. And then the second listener note is from, quote, a West Coast follower. I like the anonymity here.
Yes, me too.
So this person writes, I tuned in this week to settle the unsettled feeling that has been growing as the silence from Kensington Palace continues. I'm concerned that something very serious is happening with Catherine. I agree with your closing comments that maybe they are taking the time to recover in peace. Hopefully, they are following the Sussexes' lead and not giving the media everything it wants and demanding privacy. It's just out of character, and the inconsistency is driving us a bit mad. So true. I hope that they are taking the time. I think the more that we hear about it, the more I feel like we're imposing on her recovery in some way. So it's just, but we'll get into all that, I guess.
I was just going to say, it's feeling like a huge pendulum where now it's like the royal watchers are swinging back to like, maybe this is Occam's razor and it is just, you know, we'll see her after Easter and what they said is true, but we're all in our heads about it. So
totally.
We will talk about it more coming up.
Now, this week in royal history.
This week in royal history, moving on, as we mentioned, happy birthday to Princess Eugenie. We wanted to flash back to her arrival in 1990. The daughter of Prince Andrew and Sarah Ferguson, Princess Eugenie Victoria Helena, turns 34 this upcoming Saturday on March 23rd. So she was born at Portland Hospital, which is where Meghan famously delivered Archie, and welcomed by her older sister, Beatrice, at the time, but also Princess Diana. If you scroll back in the archives on Getty Images and also some of the coverage from the time, she did have quite a few royal faces popping up because Fergie was actually in the hospital for an additional 5 days. She didn't leave until 5 days after Eugenie was born, which was not typical, or not what we're used to, I guess. Fergie was only 30 years old and also delivered Eugenie via C-section, so that may have been a reason for the delay. I couldn't find the reason in terms of reports. I did want to pay homage briefly to Fergie's hospital departure look because it is unique. It's a power suit. It's pink, black, and white, kind of a little tuxedo-ish.
I'm clicking the link here. Ooh, wait.
Describe it for
pink
us, Roberta.
The sleeves are everything. It is. It's like a collarless, like I guess Mandarin collar jacket with satin pink sleeves, big black buttons, a white front, and then some black kind of piping. Oh, it's gorgeous. It's absolutely gorgeous.
And some of the reports also called out that the pink is totally in line with Andrew's tie, too. If you look, it was like they coordinated there. She also has a big voluminous perm. I mean, it's so, so fun to see these images. Also, I thought it was unique because they came out and did the steps at Portland Hospital in the same way, or it's not totally steps, but they came out and posed for photos. But then you also see them going around shaking a lot of hands. Like they had a much longer interaction with the public than, you know, Diana and Charles or any of the other
Kate and William,
birds we've noticed. August and Ernest are Eugenie's two children, and they were both also born at Portland Hospital, like their mama. I wanted to do a quick shout out to Annie Fitzsimmons, who is a friend of the podcast. She came on way back when, if you want to go back and check out her episode. She's a travel editor and expert, and she came on to share London recommendations ahead of the Jubilee, I think it was, right? It wasn't even the coronation.
Yeah, it was a while
ago. And we
ago.
Just go to her for all of her travel tips, not just for London, for everything. And when I was over there and I stayed an extra day for the coronation, I had the chance to do a walking tour with her, which was a total delight. And she took me to Portland Hospital, which is just a hospital, but I feel like it gives me this point of reference for all of these births and everything that keep coming up. While we're on the subject of Eugenie, thinking about how she might be celebrating her birthday, we did have the best palate cleanser at the end of last week, seeing her pop up at the Cheltenham Festival alongside Zara Tyndall, her husband Jack, Mike Tyndall was there. I feel like you and I are always pro royal cousins, just cousins in general moments. And these pictures were just so fun to see.
I know. They look so happy. I love seeing Princess Beatrice pop up the next day with Zara and Mike, and the fashions. They all brought their fashion A game,
really,
it felt like.
They really did. And I also was thinking a lot, this is so random, but the lighting was very flattering. You know, when it was just probably an overcast day there, like it just, the pictures really were
They were
good.
Laughy and smiley and huggy. Like it was a very sweet cousinly love. I don't know. I'm looking forward to seeing my cousins at Easter, and I feel like this was like such a fun little moment all of them amidst the really weird royal news that's going on.
That's what it was. I think it was just like, yes, at a horse race, you know, royals at a horse race. It just seemed perfect.
Yeah, like Kate is okay and these cousins are having a great time.
I do wonder if we'll get an update from Princess Eugenie on her actual birthday. She's always so wonderful at giving some behind the scenes pics that are always really kind of off the cuff. And I am looking forward to seeing what pops up on Saturday.
I did take a look at Princess Eugenie's Instagram right before we recorded just to see what was the latest. And she had that sweet post from Mother's Day with Fergie. And I don't know if you saw, but she called her Mumsy. It was all very sweet.
I do love that.
So hopefully we'll get some new Eugenie update soon.
Yes. Happy birthday, Eugenie.
All right. Moving on to our first bit of royal news. Just quickly, American Riviera Orchard. Since we don't know that much, I'm saying quickly.
It is a mouthful.
We're all... It is. It takes my whole segment to say it. It's 10 syllables. So, I mean, Rachel, what a time to be alive. A royal duchess possibly going to sell us some jam? This is insane. So American Riviera Orchard, if you've been living under a rock, launched last Thursday, the day our episode dropped. It was March 14th, aka the Sussexes' calendar has the date circled, I guess, because that was when they took their, quote, freedom flight, as Harry called it, from Canada to California back in 2020. That was the when they needed to get out of Canada, make sure they were in the U.S. before when we all thought borders were closing and things like that. It's just a very strange time to get back to. But I did want to go over a few things with you that I've thought of since this launch, because we've had a little space to kind of digest this. So at the time of this recording, it's actually up to 545,000 followers on Instagram, which is pretty staggering considering there is nothing material that we
have. Yeah, there's no content yet. Yeah.
Yeah. So we got those 9 pictures, which form a kind of grid photo that is the same as the website. It's very calming. It has that beautiful calligraphy with the brand name in Meghan's handwriting, which some experts have pointed out. Really beautiful there. The cipher of ARO, which is also interesting because it just reminds me of the cipher of their Sussex.com, where we had that relaunch and had the royal coat of arms or cipher.
Yeah.
I remember immediately contacting you, Rachel, and saying it sounds like arch, like Archewell, because A-R Orchard. So I'm wondering if that plays into the choice of the name. We know that American Riviera has, for a long time, I think someone wrote 100 years, has been the nickname for Santa Barbara and that area. And so I went back and Googled Meghan Markle and Orchard. I was really curious about that, and I needed to weed out results from 2024. And what came up was Allison P. Davis's feature in The Cut. And this is what she wrote. Meghan sets a harvest basket in my arms, a cornucopia of fruit and vegetables from their garden, and a jar of jam from the Lily Bunny garden and larder. Meghan had the labels made on Etsy. She smiled and waved as I made my way out the door, wondering if somehow I'd missed everything she was trying to say. That feature in itself is just worth rereading, but it's fascinating because Meghan's been canning jams for at least a couple years.
I know. I feel like she's been like workshopping this with different people, like testing it out. She has like a lot of just product testers in her midst. It's so impressive.
The handmade Etsy labels, personal Etsy labels, it's just fascinating. Supposedly there's also a lemon grove and apple orchard on their estate. We know they have a sprawling estate and mansion in Montecito, which Montecito is part of the logo and brand name. I just had one prediction for the launch date and it's coming up. So the TIG shuttered April 7th, 2017. Are we going to see 7 years later at American Riviera Orchard? So we'll see if we see anything from that. I'm sure you signed up for the emails, the product launches.
Oh, of course, immediately.
The only thing that I was curious about was what your thoughts were about using this, the Sussex's royal ties, for commercial gain. I mean, does that feel like this is what this is? Because I guess for me, on the one hand, it their website, the relaunch of Sussex.com, had so many royal tie-ins. And so are they going against the Queen's edict, which is that they could not use their royal associations to generate financial gain? What do you think about that?
I mean, I guess I feel like this is, it does feel like a separate entity and a return to Meghan's roots because it so mirrors the TIG, or at least my expectations of it without having it launched. But I do think that they are for sure mentioning as much as possible the royal ties. We don't see how it integrates yet for American Riviera Orchard until we see the actual site launch, But I think that it feels like this is a nice parallel to her pre-royal days. We'll see, though.
The only tie-in I did see was the mention on their Instagram of by Meghan, the Duchess of Sussex. And I just don't know if that is going to feel murky to anyone across the pond. Who knows?
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I can't wait to see all the nut butters and all of the jams and all of that. And I feel like that's what I'll be shopping, honestly. Let's be real.
Petition to also, from here on out, both of us just call it ARO, because this is too much.
ARO.
It's taking too
ARO.
Long. One more update about the Sussexes. The royal family's official website combined both Harry and Meghan's bios into one. It says that they update this regularly, so this isn't anything to raise eyebrows about. They added a new link to their Sussex.com site from the royal family's official site, which I feel like is kind of a sign-off from them. It's a nice way to tie both together.
Yeah, it does feel like an endorsement. Yeah, it does feel nice that they're linking that. I thought that was good, too. All right, shall we move on to Kate Middleton? Spotted, officially. Can we rest easy now?
I can. I don't know about everyone else, though.
Yeah, everyone else is nervous still. But so she was spotted on Saturday at Windsor Farm with William. This is 1 mile from Adelaide Cottage. William was slightly incognito. He had a hat on. He would have been harder to recognize except for his 6'3 self. Kate was not at all incognito. Her outfit was even ID'd, which made me laugh. You know, people were like, she's wearing an Umbro men's rugby hoodie. And I will say that neon kind of stripe on the arms made it probably an easier item to ID, but it was fascinating to see us shopping her first look out of
the house. I will say, the socks were the non-slip hospital socks. I definitely recognize those from my 3 days spent in the hospital for dengue fever.
Yeah.
So I was like, or just like a pair of woolly socks. But that's what I thought of immediately.
Yeah,
I
thought of
them.
Like compression socks or something. But it is a look. I feel like there's a lot of talk about her socks for some reason. Also, people check the metadata that confirm we're now all up to speed about metadata, which I definitely wasn't 10 days ago. So it confirms that the visit was on Saturday and the location, this sighting is legit. The photos were published by The Sun. The video was published by TMZ, and it was said to be filmed by a bystander. Do you feel like this was an effort to demonstrate proof of life? Like this was coordinated?
I kind of have to think it was. I mean, I think that they are aware of how many people are concerned now with the princess's whereabouts. And so I think that this was sort of a sanction, because we know that the palace didn't want people to run the photo from Commonwealth Day of her looking away out the window in the car with William. Also, they didn't want them to run the photo of Kate Middleton with her mother, Carol, in the car. So this felt like something that was sort of sanctioned, right?
Yes, I agree. I feel like they would have shut it down if not. And also, she wasn't at all trying to hide. I did like this perspective from Elizabeth Holmes, who talked this week on her Instagram account about the danger of allowing the smartphone-wielding public to invade their privacy with what seems like Kate and William's blessing, because I feel like just the control stretches. It's like you have the battle between, you know, them, the palace and the press, but now you're adding this okay to filming with the smartphone, because that feels a little scary. Like it could escalate to me.
Yeah. If it is sanctioned too, like they are sort of invading their own privacy for a temporary ceasefire, it feels like, when this might have long-term effects that they don't want.
Yes.
It's totally. And the twin announcements of TMZ and The Sun was also really interesting too. I felt like at the exact same time.
Exactly.
That was fascinating.
Exactly. Which made it feel like they really were okay with this footage getting out. This also follows a report from Roy Anika in the Sunday Times. She's, of course, the journalist that's famous for her scoops on the Waleses. She sat down with Prince William last June for his first interview as the Prince of Wales. She was the only one to get that access. This report, kind of an update, feels like, you know, has the sourcing is friends of the couple. So that does feel, in royal code words, to be as close as you can get a lot of the time. She shared a variety of tidbits, and I just wanted to lay out the ones that struck me the most. The first was just that the mother
Mother's Day image was intended to be a reassuring way to thank the public for the support. And Kate was really shaken by what happened, and in particular, the fallout and hysteria. The quote from the friend says there was nothing sinister with Kate's editing, just a desire to project the polished image that the public has come to expect from them. So that was interesting. Also, this piece clarifies what, quote, after Easter meant when that statement was came out in January, that they meant the end of their children's school holidays, not Easter weekend. This return to Lanbrook happens on April 17th. So we may need to adjust our expectations, if we have any expectations left, about when we will officially see Kate next. It does also, you know, this comes at the same time as reports saying that no final decision about her next appearance has been made. And she may pop up Easter weekend, which is a big weekend where we see a lot of the royals stepping out for church services. So TBD there. That was also in this report. Also, according to friends, Kate is going to discuss her recovery when she's ready, potentially out on engagements where she feels the most comfortable. What they said would happen is what's happening, that they weren't going to have any sort of response for this block of time after that announcement about her surgery. We'd see her after Easter, and she is, quote, not a show pony, was part of this article. And William's also very concerned with all of this, that this debacle with all the press and attention and the conspiracy theories and everything is going the way of Diana, and he's really hell-bent on protecting their bubble. That's what the article describes. Final tidbit that I thought was very up for discussion between you and me is just that there will be likely a new photo incoming from Kate and William, because Prince Louis's birthday is coming up quite soon on April 23rd, but there's no confirmation or word on whether or not Kate will snap it. And I think that this is what has given me the most thought, is just how tricky this has become in terms of trust, but also just talking about the Diana effect, how the handout practice became something that countered the paparazzi interest, right? Because they gave snapshots of their family life, but now that the trust is gone, as we're seeing again, like a lot of Kate's photos are being examined, like the grandchildren photo with the Queen several months before she died. There's a lot being called into question. I just think their whole method likely will have to change.
Yeah. I mean, like you said, we're all experts on metadata now. So I feel like that's something that they're probably considering. I mean, some of the most beautiful pictures of the royal family are from those professional photographers like Chris Jackson, Samir Hussein. So Will War, who did the video. Like, I just think that we will probably see more of that if they read the room.
I think often about those three photos from the Queen and Prince Philip. Chris Jackson was given access behind the scenes for this anniversary, and he was able to capture something, but he was able to do it within the Getty Images rules. So I think that that's probably a good method to go. Anyways, this article was very, very fascinating. I did want to call out this Prince Harry zing, which just really caught me off guard as I was reading. Roberta, I'm sure you were feeling the same way. This quote that Kate and William are not like Prince Harry obsessing and scrolling through Twitter, but they know it has broken through. In other words, that it's gone way beyond what they ever expected. And this is, again, according to a friend. So I thought that the zing of Prince Harry was a little uncalled for.
Unnecessary. Yes. Yeah, I agree. I totally agree.
So TBD, we'll see what's to come. I feel like every day is a big plot twist, swerve. Who knows what's next? All right. And now we are thrilled to welcome the 9th Earl Spencer. We do want to preface this by just giving a bit of a trigger warning that we do discuss incidents of sexual abuse for anyone that feels uncomfortable. We just wanted to give that warning.
Roros, we're honored and privileged to welcome the 9th Earl Spencer to the podcast. He's co-host of the Rabbit Hole Detectives podcast, and he's the author of 7 history books, including several Sunday Times bestsellers. He holds a degree in modern history from Oxford University, and he's here today to discuss his most recent book, a deeply personal and harrowing account of his boarding school years called A Very Private School, a Memoir. Welcome, Charles.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
This must have been an extremely difficult book to write. You reveal for the first time that you were the victim of physical, verbal, and sexual abuse at the boarding school Maidwell, but also so many others were victims as well. And somehow, bafflingly, Maidwell Hall still exists. The school has released an official statement, but have you heard personally from them since publishing?
Actually, that's interesting. I haven't heard from them at all. They have put out a public statement, as you say, but they've not addressed anything to me as yet.
You know, we both spent the weekend with your book. I think what stood out to us so uniquely is your books paint such a vivid picture of the complexities of a boarding school education, how it's considered such a fundamental part of an elite British upbringing. But for centuries and up through pretty recent times, like the 70s when you were a student at Madewell, it feels like both parent and child find themselves more focused on the generational commitment of sending their kids off than the misery and suffering of the experience that they endured. Do you see the merits of a boarding school education in modern times? It was interesting to hear how your father at one point considered a homeschool education as an alternative.
Yes, it is a traditional burden inflicted on people from my background. I'm not anti-boarding school. I am dead against it for people before they're a teenager, because how can they know what they're letting themselves in for? I think that it shouldn't be allowed before the age of 13. It should only be allowed at 13. If people are sort of absolutely sure it's the right thing for their child. I think what's sad is, you know, my parents were not bad people. They were good people. And my father was a very loving father. He was my primary parent. And as you say, he very sweetly thought of the possibility of homeschooling, but it wasn't possible. I mean, when he suggested it to his people from the same background, they just thought he was ridiculous. And so, you know, that idea was squashed. He did later tell me it was the worst day of his father for me out of his four children, sending me that day. He knew it was entirely wrong. So there was a sort of acknowledgement there.
Yeah, because you were only eight. It is strikingly young. And you think about that. I'm a mom and I have a six-year-old and I keep picturing how young that is. You know, it really is so vulnerable, such a vulnerable time.
It is vulnerable. Look, some of my friends were lucky and went to places which were run by decent head teachers who cared about kids. But still, they were so young. And I have to say, I know this is scientifically proven, isn't it? It's not me. Boys at eight are much younger than girls at eight emotionally. And I look back at those early days, looking at the people who started at that school with me, some of whom were seven, and they were babies. You know, they were clutching their teddy bears and looking totally forlorn. And one boy was not even informed by his parents that they were leaving him there that day. They dumped him at the school and left, and he was looking for them. But obviously, they're gone for several weeks.
Oh, so heartbreaking. Well, one thing that struck us early on is your portrait that you paint of your early childhood, in particular, your Silfield years, or what we here in the U.S. would call like preschool, kindergarten years. The pictures of you playing chess in bed with the Disney stickers behind you on the bed are so charming. Can you walk us through sort of your perfect day at Park House?
Yes, Park House is this beautiful, we're very lucky, very, very large house that was on the Sandringham Royal Estate. And I think it was originally built as a guest house, really, for an overspill of people when they stayed at the royal house down the road. And it was just so lovely. Obviously, as a child, I didn't realize quite how privileged I was. But when I look back, it was totally gorgeous. You know, it had a large-ish garden and swimming pool and a tennis court, which were very unusual back in the 60s. And we had really lovely neighbors, nice people. And then a really beautiful school, Silfield, in the local town where my sister Diana and I attended with our local friends, and it was just so easy. And I, by the way, I do want people listening to this to know I'm not doing this with sort of rose-tinted spectacles. I've checked with the people who were there with me, and we had this idyllic childhood.
How do you think your life would be different if your father had decided on that alternative to Madewell, if you had done day school or homeschool or something like that? How would your life have been different, do you think?
Well, I assume, if we take the assumption that there wouldn't have been any catastrophes at home, I think I'd have been a lot happier, you know, through life. I think it was a deeply traumatizing event. I was hearing today, this just before I came on here, somebody got in touch to say, he's the main friend I go to at Madewell, actually. I call him William Purefoy in the book, and he was ringing to discuss the book. And he is saying how friends of his, who I know by name, they weren't at school with me, have been calling him up in tears, saying how triggering all this is, because they've had to bury this stuff. And what the English do, especially people who are from privileged backgrounds who've suffered this sort of abuse, is they tend to either bottle it up or they touch on it with humor to sort of deflect the true impact. It's been staggering to me how widespread this issue is. I write about one male single-sex school, and yet I've heard from so many people who went through similar and have never told anyone. They've never told a single person how awful it was for them. And to be honest, as an author, I've never written a book where anyone had this deeply personal reaction. And I'm thrilled with that. I don't care how the book does commercially. I love the fact that it seems to be helping people. That really is fantastic.
Yeah. Do you think boarding schools now are different than how they were back then? I mean, has there been a stark change that you've noticed?
Yes. So the reason I called this a very private school was obviously a play on the fact that it was a private school. But the whole reason that it worked as a place of perversion and abuse was because the headmaster was a really terrifyingly bad man. He was a sadist and a pervert. And he used all the powers that he had at his fingertips to close the school down even more. I heard from a son of my godfather today, who actually went to Maidwell a few years before me. And he said that after he left the school, he and his father dropped by suddenly unannounced. And they wanted to drop by and say hello to Mr. Porch. Or in fact, the father did. The boy didn't want to see him ever again in his life. And this completely panicked the headmaster. He did not want grown-ups in that place, were not welcome, and he got rid of them as quickly as possible. So answering your question, it's not possible now to have that level of imposed privacy. We did not have a landline that we had access to. Obviously, there were no cell phones back then or computers. We had a single letter home on a Sunday morning, which was supervised and often read by our master in charge. So it was easy if you got a really bad man in charge, supported by very, very bad henchmen, to get away with this stuff. I think it would be a lot harder today.
Mm-hmm. Totally.
We did want to jump back again, talking about your earlier years. We love how you describe another pic, the one of you and Diana on your first day at Silfield. Your description, you looking resplendent in a piercingly scarlet blazer. I love your vivid depictions throughout the book. Also, the flexibility of the school when they allowed Diana to peek in on you and make sure you were okay. Can you tell us about those two moments?
Yes. So I was very excited to be joining the school where my big sister was going. And my father always had a camera on the go, and he insisted on taking a photo. It would be back in 1968 when I was four, standing in my scarlet uniform with S on it for Silfield, the name of the school. And Diana next to me, and she looked sort of, you know, like a big sister, half proud and half resentful that she's sharing the stage with a younger. But she was very good to me as a child and looked after me. Our mother left when I was quite young, and she sort of stepped in very kindly. I remember the old lady in charge of that school, she was called Miss Lowe. She told me many, many years later, actually after Diana had passed away, that she remembers my first day so vividly because she had Diana in her class and Diana wasn't concentrating at all. And Miss Lowe knew why. And she just said to Diana, "It's okay, you can go and check on him." And she came just to see how I was doing in my class. And then she went back and told Miss Lowe, "He's doing fine." And she remembered that as a very sweet moment of a big sister looking out for her brother. But of course, you know, you're dealing 4 years later, I'm packed off to a boarding school. And there's another photograph of me next to Diana, which my father took, where Diana's looking, you know, very relaxed in front of a camera, as she always did. And my nanny's standing there checking I'm not going to fall apart with emotion. But you look at the contrast between that smiley little boy at age four, I was a very happy-go-lucky kid, and this terrified child about to be sent off to live with strangers. I'd never, ever spent a night away from home without a family member. And I was being packed off for 3 months. You know, I was allowed out for a couple of nights and one long weekend during those 13 weeks. And it was just beyond my comprehension. I had no context to my life where I could think that this made sense. It was just utterly terrifying.
Yeah. With Diana as sort of your fierce protector from the earlier, did she give you any advice before? I know she was in boarding school at the time.
I can't remember, to be honest. So I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and as we mentioned at the start, you know, we were introducing you, you've mostly written historical nonfiction. What was it like to delve into memoir for you? You talk about the response you're getting and it's unique. We'd love to know what the challenges of that were.
Yes. So normally I write straight history books. I take a moment in a British sovereign, a king's reign or queen's reign, and it's a flashpoint in which I tell the story of the age. And so it's accessible history. It is nonfiction, but it's accessible. It's not academic. This was something completely different. So I started a file on my PC. I've been doing therapy for years, and eventually it became clear that this school was at the root of an enormous amount of my problems. And so I just started a file and added to it when I had a memory about school. And it could be something very mundane, or it could be something quite horrific. And then I realized I had an awful lot of stuff there. And then I kept bumping into, it was a very small school, there were only 75 of us at any one time. I kept bumping into people, one in LA, one at my house in England, and others who had been at this place. And when I opened the subject of this school and our years there, they pretty much, all of them, just reeled in horror, recoiled, and things like, I've not thought about that for 40 odd years or whatever. And then I got them to open up a bit with their permission. You know, obviously I wasn't bullying. And then told me the most appalling levels of abuse that they had suffered. And this was very triggering, actually, because I like to think that I'd sort of got to a point of understanding, you know, not acceptance, but understanding of what had happened to me. But to hear really appalling things, you know, rapes and terrible things that had been their lot in life was really almost too much to bear. And what normally I'd take 3 years to write one of these books. That's what I do. I do a year of really thinking about it, a year of writing it, and a year of editing it. But this one took 4.5 years because sometimes it was just so difficult to write.
Wow. Yeah. Well, you cover in your years at Madewell, you cover in the book 1972 to 77, and kind of later on towards the end of that time frame was a day that you were able to sort of break Madewell's strict rules and attend a Westminster Abbey service for the Queen and Philip's anniversary. You were godson to Queen Elizabeth at the time, which prompted your first piece of journalism. Can you tell us a little more about that?
Yes, that's true. I think it was November 72. And it was the Queen and Prince Philip's silver wedding anniversary, and I was invited. Now, this was a bit of a problem for the school. They didn't allow us out, but you couldn't exactly decline an invitation from the Queen. So I went in my boarding school's best, you know, my Sunday best suit. And I remember I was standing next to my father, and the Queen and Prince Philip processed up the aisle of Westminster Abbey. And my father noted with very great affection for Her Majesty the fact that she looked down at me and gave me an enormous smile. And I worked out subsequently, I must have been the youngest person in Westminster Abbey that day because I'm about a month younger than Prince Edward, Duke of Edinburgh. So that was rather lovely and very charming of her to do that.
And then you wrote about it for the school paper, was it? Or?
Yeah, there was an annual magazine at the school and I wrote about it. And it was, I became a journalist. I used to, for a decade, I worked on NBC's Today Show as a reporter. But my very first written piece of journalism was my account of that day. It's very, very much an eight-year-old's take on a rather grand occasion. I'm not sure I nailed all the details quite correctly.
Probably the best point of view, though.
Yes.
Definitely. And a bright spot in all of the darkness that was kind of going on around you. You also almost got to be a page boy at the opening of Parliament, but then had to cancel because of your common entrance exam. Is that right?
Yes. So I was a page boy for a couple of years to Her Majesty, and I did do two or three of the openings of Parliament. The page boys are the usually 13, 14-year-olds, and they are in a scarlet long tailcoat with breeches. Not exactly everyday wear. And I did that. But when I was at Madewell, at this fairly horrendous boarding school, I was meant to do a service in, I think it's in June, they do a Knight of the Garter ceremony at Windsor Castle. And it clashed with the day I was having to take the exam to go from Madewell to Eton College. And so I was in a real state about how I'd do both. But luckily, Buckingham Palace were kind enough to excuse me. They had someone stand in for me instead.
Oh, that's good that they had a backup, I guess, but so you could focus on your studies.
Yes.
So you weave your own personal ancestral history into the retelling of these years of your childhood, and something we've also been fascinated by thanks to your wife, Countess Spencer's 1508 website and email series. We are huge fans. We love reading those weekly emails. Her research and exploration of Althorp House, its previous inhabitants. Is a deep love of history just part and parcel to living at Althorp?
Well, I think it would be a pity if you didn't love history and you were living there. I mean, my kids, I've never pushed it. You know, I got an enormous number of children. I have seven, or just the seven, as I like to say. I can't say they're all imbued with history. But on Saturday, there was a very sweet thing. We had my 18-year-old daughter, Lara's 18th, in the house. And my 30-year-old son, he's just turned 30 last week, Louis, gave a speech about how wonderful she is in his eyes. They've always been very close. And he referenced her qualities to her aunt Diana and various striking people in the family lineage. So I realized that he knew quite a lot more about the family line than I had worried that he did.
Well, that's good. I mean, we've learned a lot too. And can you tell us a little bit how that came about, the Spencer 1508? It's so fascinating, and where it's headed, perhaps?
Well, it's I'm not sure where it's headed. I think, you know, with social media, it's just one of those things, a communication without the outside world. I've always felt very lucky to be, I see myself, although technically I'm the owner of Allthorpe, I see myself as very much the caretaker of it for one generation. And, you know, it's just, it's fun to share things with people through social media. I mean, I have Instagram account and all that sort of thing. I think it's nice for people. I mean, you have to balance it. I don't want to be having people think, oh, look, he's showing off this or that. But it's I know how lucky I am to be looking after this place, and I want people to enjoy aspects of it.
Yeah, it's all so fascinating. What has been the most interesting thing that you've uncovered since living there? Has there been anything that's really surprised you?
Yeah, the most interesting thing I didn't discover it, but I rediscovered it, is a sundial from the early 1600s that belonged to the Washington family.
Oh, wow.
And the Washingtons lived nearby. They were cousins of the Spencers. And before they emigrated to America, they lived in a house that we lent to them. And there is their sundial. I keep it in a strong room now. But it's got the Washington star on it. I had not realized before this that was a symbol, a crest they had before George Washington became a great man, a great figure of history. And that's amazing to connect that back to the Washingtons 400 years ago.
That is so cool. That is an amazing find and a piece of history. Well, thank you so much, Charles, for joining us. A Very Private School, a memoir, is available now wherever books are sold. Thank you so much again.
It was my pleasure. Thank you both.
What an honor to have Charles on the pod. Thank you. And please, everyone, check out his book.
I know. I'm still pinching myself that Diana's brother was on our podcast. It really is like the closest we will ever come to her, and it's amazing.
It's time for the Royal Highs and Lows.
All right, before we adjourn the Royal Pod, our highs and lows, my low is this really strange story that the Russian media claimed for a little bit earlier this week that King Charles had passed away. There were fake statements on palace letterhead circulating around Twitter that said the king passed away unexpectedly yesterday afternoon. It was picked up by two major newspapers in Russia, and Buckingham Palace had to release a statement saying, "We're pleased to confirm the king continues to fulfill his work duties and attend to private affairs." It just plays into this trust issue, I think, that we're all experiencing from the photo fallout.
Yeah, absolutely. Fake news is really rampant right now with the royals. Feels that way. Milo is the Diana Award disconnect and just the fact that Harry and William weren't able to even virtually be in the same room. I'm so thrilled, of course, for Tessie Ojo, who has been a guest on this podcast. She is the CEO of the Diana Award, and her leadership has just been remarkable to watch, and a coup to get both brothers participating. But just reading about the details, that the ceremony was 7 hours. William gave a speech first at the Science Museum at 7 p.m., then winners returned to the hotel and had to Zoom with Harry between midnight and 1 a.m. when the awards ended at 9 p.m. That just seems crazy because it is a logistical feat, but I can't help but feel like it was a workaround so that the brothers weren't in the same room. It just makes me sad.
My high this week is just the spotting of Kate. I feel so confused that I still have friends and family asking if that's really her. I just am like, it's my mind is blown. Like, it's totally her. So, so happy to see her. There you are. We are so relieved to finally kind of put some of this to rest, although I feel like people are still fanning the flames, weirdly.
I know. I do want to just add, Lauren, one of our devoted Roros, called out the fact that was it wonderful to have the whole world kind of in our world for the week? Like, it was for the wrong reasons, but the community like really expanded over last week because everyone loves the royals right now.
I know. I hate it, but I love it because I hate the conspiracy theories, but
I don't want to hear from people, but I do want to. I love that you're in our world.
People are paying attention.
Yes, yes. All right, my high is just this report that Charles might participate in Trooping the Color this year. It's very much TBD. He really wants to be there. He's been advised to avoid large crowds, of course, given his cancer treatment. But I think that this sort of inkling of hope feels very wonderful. I guess they're talking about maybe he would ride in a carriage. He can't ride horseback, which would be the tradition, but I would love to see his face as part of the occasion in June.
Yeah, that's a bright spot to look forward to for sure. All right, just a reminder before we close, please leave us a 5-star review. This one is from Redheaded Anne Girl, which I love the name. They said, I love listening to weekly to hear intelligent perspectives of royal news without harsh criticism or rabbit hole theories. Rachel and Roberta are refreshingly balanced in their coverage in all things royal, and I love their authenticity. Listening to them is like having a nice chat with my dearest friends. Keep up the great work, ladies. Thank you, Redheaded Anne Girl.
Such a nice, nice note.
Reminder to subscribe so you never miss an episode. Follow us on Instagram at Royally Obsessed Podcast and send us an email, info@gallerypodcast.com. Until next week,
God save the pod.
Her Majesties of Royally Obsessed have retired for this episode. God save the pod. And if you fancy the podcast, give Royally Obsessed the royal rating of 5 stars on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Instagram at Royally Obsessed Podcast and join our Facebook group, Royally Obsessed. Royally Obsessed is a Gallery Podcast production.